This is the Court Leader's Advantage, a podcast series for court professionals and by court professionals. Brought to you by thecourtleader.net and in cooperation with NACOM, the National Association for Court Management. In last month's podcast, we discussed the benefits of court self-service centers, both for litigants and for courts. Although they are not universally accepted, these centers can help prepare self-represented litigants to navigate the exotic terrain of the courtroom. They can also expedite court proceedings and weed out inappropriate arguments. Less obvious, but equally as important, the information these centers provide helps boost the public's trust and confidence in the courts. And we well know that the public's perception of courts has been woefully lagging these last several years. A basic principle of self-service centers, in fact, a principle of all public-facing court staff, is we cannot give legal advice. Yet this prohibition is more nuanced than it first appears. There are a host of questions that seem more procedural than legal, questions many self-represented litigants may not even know enough to ask about. How much should courts tell litigants? How much should courts volunteer, even if the litigants don't know enough to ask? I'm Pete Kiefer, and welcome to the Court Leader's Advantage podcast series. This month, we're going to look at what courts can, do, and should tell litigants. Today's episode presents several situations self-represented litigants sometimes find themselves in. These are situations that do not immediately appear to involve giving legal advice. Rather, they seem, on their face, procedural. But they are obscure enough that only individuals who have been in the system might know their implications. Here to discuss these situations are Nathan DeVries, supervising attorney with the Self-Help Services Unit of the Superior Court in San Bernardino, California; Robert Southers, managing attorney for the Self-Help and Dispute Resolution Center at the Franklin County Municipal Court in Columbus, Ohio; Jenna Elsness, program manager for the Minnesota Judicial Branch's Self-Represented Litigant Program; and Danielle Trujillo, court administrator for the Municipal Court in Littleton, Colorado. Thank you all for joining today's podcast. Let me start with the first situation. A defendant comes to court to resolve his license suspension. He settles the underlying court case and walks out of the courthouse thinking that he once again possesses a valid license. He's unaware that he must also go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, ask the DMV to give him his license back, provide proof that he has satisfied the court's hold, and usually pay an added fee. Defendants often leave court without realizing they must go to the DMV. Should court staff inform litigants that their work is only half done, even if they don't ask? Should the court describe the DMV process, including the fact that they very likely will have to pay an added fee? Nathan DeVries?
Yeah, so in this situation, generally with license suspensions, the two times that at least our center typically deals with that is for child support cases and for small claims involving automobile accidents. For child support, that's usually involving the Department of Child Support Services, and usually they'll handle the license suspension part to renew that license. But for small claims, we do instruct the customers of sort of that next step in the process of letting them know that they're going to have to go to the DMV and that there is some additional steps, because I feel that's an essential part of them knowing. But as far as the DMV's specific procedures, we don't usually go into that because we don't keep abreast of that. And that's more of a practical issue than a legal and like ethical issue of what our restraints could be, because we can't keep abreast of what all of the different agencies' internal procedures and practices and forms might be. So we'll inform them generally that there is additional steps they have to do, that they'll have to go to the DMV to finalize process and show them the court orders. And there might be an additional fee, but the specifics of that, we'll say we'll refer them to the DMV to get more information on that procedure, just so we aren't giving out misinformation, because accuracy is also one of the key things that we want to make sure that we're giving out accurate information.
Danielle Trujillo?
Lots of times in courts, we believe that everything is very black and white, But there's a lot of gray in between. And people come to us not knowing any of these processes. And we're quick to relinquish things from them. And we give them a lot of language and a lot of documents up front to say, hey, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're going to do this next. But then when we take those actions, we don't follow up with instructions on here's how you can remedy it. Here's how you can fix it. We want to help you. And so I think the license is a huge issue for people, right? How do you get to and from work? These are people's lives. And I recognize that sometimes people have challenges in their lives that they can't pay court fines. And in Colorado, we've done a lot of things to no longer suspend licenses if you can't pay, right? So we've taken a lot of action legally, but that doesn't mean people weren't in the process or aren't still in the process, still trying to remedy that. And so it's our responsibility, I believe, as courts, to make sure that they know all of the proper steps. And like Nathan said, we don't know DMV's process, but for you to be able to give them the contact, the website, how you think it's going to work, you know there's a fee involved. You don't know how much, and that's okay to say, we don't know how much. To actually have pamphlets and things like that to hand to them from DMV of here's how the process works for DMV, and building those relationships within the courts and DMV to know that, hey, what's your latest update? Can we make sure we have that information so we can hand it to a defendant when they need to get their license back is huge. So I think there's lots of gray area here where you don't have to give them all the steps or tell them all the specific details, but you can give them a broad outline of what they could expect. And I think if you take the standpoint of one and done, right? We want you to come into our courthouse once or to go through this one time and then be done. We want to give you all the information. I don't want you to keep calling the clerk back over and over and over again, because that not only creates frustration for you, but also for staff. And so it's a twofold issue that if we can give them plain language at the beginning, not legalese, that very plain language of what they can expect and the steps that they have to do, especially when working with another agency like DMV, that there are steps in the process, it's going to help everybody involved.
In the next situation, a litigant comes to court seeking a restraining order, or in some states, it's known as an order of protection. Should court staff assertively refer litigants to a local woman's shelter in case the need arises? Should the court refer her to a spousal abuse advocacy group to help her obtain the restraining order and to keep it in place through any subsequent hearings? Robbie Southers?
This is a really interesting situation, especially for our office, because while we don't specifically help with protection orders, it's something that people show up to our office for all the time. Like Danielle was saying, people will call the clerk's office hundreds of times, will get bounced around the building. And by the time they get somewhere that is actually giving them information that's helpful, they're often very frustrated. We'll often see people come in this situation because they're also looking maybe to evict that partner if they're the ones that own the home, or they're looking to solve this problem with a number of different ways. So we've trained our staff that even though we don't help with protection orders, we can still help with kind of figuring out where they need to go next. Because at least here in Columbus, they may be going to one of three different buildings in our complex to get the correct protection order. And it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to just tell them, oh, you need to go to one of these three places. Instead, we're going to have the flyers from each three and help them figure out which one is the right place to start. In terms of sending them to outside groups, we also have resources for that. We don't want someone leaving our office not knowing those next steps. So we'll give them kind of a checklist of first thing you're going to do is go to the correct office and apply for that protection order. Then if you need these additional resources, here's pamphlets for them. We let them know to also ask for resources when they get to the right office, because they may have better resources than we have. But we want to make sure that if we know something, we want to make sure that those people do know about it and we give it to them. Something we hear in our office quite a bit, I'm sure everyone else on the call could say the same thing, is oftentimes people will say, you know, you're the first person that took 5 minutes just to listen to me today. Mm-hmm. And when we take that 5 minutes to listen to them, instead of just saying, you know, you're not in the right place, go here, we find out some more things that might help them figure out their problem. So we might be able to talk to them about an eviction. We might be able to talk to them about other legal solutions, or it might just be, yeah, it really doesn't sound like you're safe tonight. We're going to send you to the place for a protection order, but we want to make sure you have the resource no matter what. So we'll give you information about the shelter, or, you know, maybe you're really nervous about going through the process on your own. They should give you more information about an advocacy group when you get over there, but that's something to make sure you ask for when you apply. It really just depends on the situation with the person and taking that extra 5 minutes just to hear them out and give them a chance to kind of get that all off their chest.
Jenna Elsness?
This is a great question and a situation we run into very frequently as well. So I think it is absolutely appropriate to give resources as available. And I think what's really important to clarify in that is that you're providing resources for someone to empower themselves to choose what resources are most applicable at the time of their need too. So even if they aren't feeling like they need the shelter resources or advocacy group resources at that time, maybe at some point throughout the process, that is something that they're interested in. Or as Robbie was sharing, you know, there might be times when they're looking for more support than we can potentially give, or there's always the intersectionality of the civil protective orders with some of the criminal cases. And there may be resources available on your list or something that you're handing to someone that they might not be interested in looking at the moment, but it would be a great resource for them to have when it's needed.
In this third situation, a tenant comes to court because she has been served with an eviction notice and she wants to contest it. She shares that she does not have enough money to move, and she does not know where she would live if she is thrown out of her apartment. Should court staff refer her to a local shelter in case the court rules that she has to be evicted? Should court staff refer her to a tenant advocacy group that could assist her in contesting the eviction? Robbie?
This goes right along with an idea that we see a lot of. Sometimes the legal solution to someone's problem isn't really the solution that they need. We can give this person legal information all day, but if the case just isn't in her favor, the self-help center is just really there to help her access the system, not necessarily to find some way for her to win that case. One way that we've tried to challenge that a little bit and tried to still give those people a solution to their problems is we've instituted an eviction court social worker program. So that person is at eviction court each day. They meet with people who maybe don't have the outcomes that they're hoping for. And we have direct referral resources to shelters, to rental assistance, to other housing assistance throughout the city to help fast track those people into getting the services they need. That's been really helpful for those people that, you know, are going to suffer from that harmful impact of an eviction, that maybe that is the proper legal remedy to that dispute, but it doesn't really solve that person's personal problems and their issues going forward. We found that to be super helpful, and having someone who's trained on the medical issues behind it and the social work issues behind it has been super helpful to make sure that we're catching everything that maybe an attorney wouldn't be trained to look out for.
Nathan?
A lot of times, especially tenants coming in to self-help, they aren't looking for necessarily something that we can really help them with, because they may not have grounds for actually contesting the eviction, because we'll ask them what they're actually looking to challenge and they completely agree they didn't pay their rent and it might be a perfectly valid grounds for eviction. So the actual needs they're looking for may not really be the legal solution, and they're really just looking for more time. And sometimes the legal process can help with that, and we can help with different stages of that. But we do partner with other organizations and nonprofit organizations to help with different stages of the process, because especially once it's getting to the later stages and they're looking to really do like motions to challenge judgments or things like that, and that's what they're looking to do, that's really going beyond what self-help can do to provide meaningful things, because that's when they're having to draft actual pleadings and things like that. And to provide any meaningful assistance with some of those things, they need to get legal advice. But there are some nonprofit organizations that we refer our customers to that we know have the resources and the attorneys to actually assist with that and have gone through that process. But then there are those other needs. So we do assist. There's 2-on-1 that we refer customers to if they need some of those immediate assistance and things like that in order to meet their immediate needs for shelter, things like that. So I think there is the appropriate thing of referring them to there, but knowing that there are some limits for what self-help can do based off the stage, because sometimes any amount of assistance, the procedures are just so complicated that any assistance really requires legal advice. And at that point, we sort of have to refer them to local attorneys, things like that, that can potentially help them get the assistance they need in those situations.
Danielle?
I think what we brought up mostly here, both Robbie and Nathan did, is that partnership aspect. How are we working with our community partners in order to actually make sure that people in our community have the resources that they need? And oftentimes, we know that these situations are very complicated and that they involve a lot of different aspects. And so what kind of partnerships are we actually building at each courthouse, at each level, in order to leverage our greater community? We don't have to be the experts in everything as court staff. As long as we can point you in the direction that you need to go, and we know that there's community partnership out there, we can actually be more helpful to our citizens.
Jenna?
So what I thought was really interesting about this question was also considering the timing. I think to what Danielle said is also that relationship piece, that we're building a relationship with the customer. So with that empathetic and courteous conversation, we can recognize what might be most helpful at that time. So in this situation, what I think is interesting is that the timing of giving some of these resources could cause some anxiety for the person. And just keeping that in mind as well, that we're not necessarily telling them what could happen or what is going to happen, but giving them resources and clarifying that they have them available regardless of what does happen, and also giving them an opportunity to circle back if they need us again. So I'm envisioning something like, here are the resources that are available. We're not sure what could happen in this situation, but you have them just in case. And if you do run into a situation where you're looking for some additional help, please feel free to circle back with us afterwards.
In this situation, a defendant comes to court to have his criminal record expunged. In many states, expungement is a complex process, often involving serving the prosecutor, multiple law enforcement agencies, victims, and the probation department. Sometimes law enforcement agencies will not expunge arrest records, even if the court expunges the court case. Should court staff describe the expungement process, including any pitfalls the defendant might find along the way, even if the defendant doesn't ask? Danielle?
This is a huge one that continues to change and evolve in recent years and keeps kind of going in lots of different directions. So I think it's really important that you understand what the process is that's going on in your state, number one, and how it's changing and evolving. And then what was the intent behind those laws that have been enacted? What were they thinking when those things changed? And so how are you best serving your customers to help them have the outcomes that they want? When people are coming to you to request that their cases are being sealed, it's because it's affecting their life, usually adversely. And so how do we help them get on track in order to not have that adversity anymore in their life? And so the more you can give them information here about what the process looks like, the better you're going to help them reconcile that we're here to help them, not to work against them. And so some of this goes into when you're working with, again, another partner, another agency, like the law enforcement agency, what does it look like for them? For us, we have to send them there and we give them a pamphlet that very specifically lines out that they're going to have to pay an additional fee and they're going to have to do it through them or their case will not be completely sealed and it'll continue to show up on their criminal record. And if that's the number one thing that they wanted, that won't happen until they take the next step. And it's not a step we can take for them. They have to do it themselves. And if they have questions about it, if they can't pay the fee, then talk to us then. Keep asking us if you need to. We've done our part and we've sent them what they need, but you have to take one more step. And if they keep calling back, hey, did you contact them? We've even gone above and beyond to contact the law enforcement agency and say, what's missing? And if it's still just that fee and the person going in and filling out that additional piece of paper, then we'll call the defendant back again and let them know, hey, we've talked with them and this is what you're still missing there. So taking that extra step, because this is truly what separates people from continuously getting housing and jobs. And when they can't do that, then they turn to other avenues. And we don't want to see them in the criminal justice system anymore. We want them to be successful citizens. And so how can we help them do that?
Jenna?
I think that it's important to outline the entire process for someone and also identify where they might run into those obstacles so that they can be cognizant of that when it comes up. Just clarifying that we can't say, again, like I've said before, what is exactly going to happen, but here are some potential options using phrases like in my experience, and keep in mind always the ability to clarify and say, I encourage you to seek legal advice, or there could be a different outcome this time. But I do think it's really important to outline the process and really point out where it could become difficult or where they may encounter challenges.
And Pete, if I could, I had a little response to situation four as well. We see a lot of that same issue with expungements here. One problem that we see all the time that kind of goes with what Danielle was saying about like people coming back and being confused. In our process, the prosecutors send out an objection. Oftentimes people see that objection and think, oh, that means my application's been denied. they then skip the court hearing, and then the judge is forced to deny their application. Mm-hmm. So we, every time we help someone with an expungement, we warn them, hey, you might get a letter from the prosecutor. That doesn't mean that your application is being denied. It just means the prosecutor has concerns. If you want us to help you understand what it says, come back in and see us. And we really encourage that coming back in instead of, you know, being shocked when they get the denial in the mail a few weeks later. Another thing we've started doing in terms of kind of taking that extra step, both Danielle and Jenna were saying about people needing jobs and housing as the big reasons for an expungement. We had someone come in right when our help center opened that wasn't eligible to seal his record, but also had a giant gang tattoo across the side of his face. So while it's not necessarily legal assistance, we sat down with that person and talked to him about tattoo removal and what that might mean about maybe that's the reason you're having trouble getting a job. It might not be your couple of minor misdemeanors. Kind of being willing to have those kind of personal, direct conversations with people, we found to be helpful, especially with expungement, because housing and jobs are such a challenge right now.
In this final situation, a small claims litigant obtains a judgment against a defendant, but doesn't know how to collect. She assumes the court will collect the judgment and simply pay her. Should court staff describe how a litigant goes about collecting on a judgment, including judgment debtor exams, garnishing wages, attaching bank accounts? Should court staff refer litigants to other organizations that can describe this process? And do such organizations even exist? Jenna?
So I would say this is similar to other situations that we've discussed. I think that the court should absolutely share their understanding of the process. And as Danielle's mentioned, you know, provide as much help to that person as you can in the time that you're spending with them. So I think if there are resources available that could be helpful or obstacles or challenges that the person might need to overcome in the process, it is both helpful and important to try and assist them in that way. The other piece that I feel like I haven't touched on that I would like to is just in that relationship building, also talking a little bit about consent or asking questions about what that person is looking for. And to what Robbie was saying, you know, the conversation can go in a number of different ways. And sometimes someone is coming to our offices for one specific issue and may not realize that there are other ways that we can help. So to answer the question specifically, yes, I think that it's important to talk about the process, some of the needs and obstacles, and also just inviting conversation, building a relationship, and being able to help as much as possible without stepping over that line into legal advice. And we've talked a little bit about how we can avoid doing that. I would say that it's a really important piece of our process and our services at the self-help centers.
Robbie?
I really like that use of the word consent and trying to figure out what kind of the underlying reason someone comes to court. Because someone may come with a dispute, say against a neighbor, and they're really upset about a situation. They think the small claims lawsuit may be their only option. But after we talked to them, we realized maybe they just want an apology, or maybe they want something else that maybe small claims can't achieve. So having that time to kind of figure out what they're actually looking for can help steer them in the right direction without giving legal advice. Part of our just normal spiel as someone's looking to file a small claims lawsuit is options for alternative dispute resolution through our pre-file mediation program, maybe options through the Attorney General of the Better Business Bureau, if that's appropriate, as well as then talking about, well, what happens after you win this case? What are those processes? What are you going to need to know? Because the last thing we want is someone to get a judgment and then be shocked that they're now in what's arguably the harder part of the case of actually getting the money from this person that they just sued. Frankly, there's not a lot of organizations out there that can help with this kind of thing unless they're going to hire like a private debt collector or something along those lines. So we want to make sure that they know about all of that before they start and before they close off those options like mediation, like the Better Business Bureau, or like finding some solution, like just talking to the neighbor and getting that apology that they actually want.
Nathan?
I would agree that, yeah, this is a really critical issue for small claims because I would agree it's the most difficult part I've found for customers because I have had many customers come in after court with their judgment. Like they come in after their 60 days or whatever. It's like, okay, where's my money? And they're like, well, yeah, it's your step in the process to collect this. The court won't do this for you. So it is a very difficult thing for them to get their head around. And it also is like a very big part of the building that trust and reliability of the court. because they have these expectations. And I think it's essential for us to provide some education and information on what those steps might look like. Yeah, we always let them know, like, we can't tell you how to get this money specifically because we don't know where the other party has their money. But we can give you the tools to help you get that information potentially and give you the resources that the court can give the support. So we try to educate them as much as we can. One thing that we used to do before COVID that we haven't brought back at this point is actually doing a collections workshop with our customers, which was actually really beneficial because one thing you mentioned at the beginning was customers not knowing what questions to ask. And so the workshop format we found is a really nice situation for that because you give a lot of broad information to people that outline a lot of the situations and they don't even think, like, it's not stuff they would even think about and not stuff that we would give specific information because they didn't ask about that. And we have limited time and resources, so we can't always do that. So the workshop format we found has been more successful for some of those situations to provide a lot of broad information. But then there's a lot of other resources that refer people to if they have to. There's different book resources or law libraries if they need to do more specific research, things like that. Then also, as Robbie was talking about, we try to educate them before the process so that they can really figure out what they actually need. Like if it's mediation services, we have some nonprofit mediation services that they can go to hopefully resolve this dispute beforehand. Because sometimes, yeah, all they are looking for is really an apology. And that's a lot better than them trying to spend 6 years trying to collect on $50 or whatever what the actual judgment amount should be. But it is also that it's their case. Because it is, so sometimes that $50 is worth all that time and energy for people to try to collect because it is a more of a principle of a thing. So we always leave that in their choice, even if I personally wouldn't bother through all this process because it is a difficult process to go through, but it's letting them make informed decisions with the information that we can provide.
Robbie, prior to today's recording, you brought up the concept of safe harbor responses. Are there types of advisory phrases that court staff could mention that would immunize them from the threat of legal liability? Some phrase like, I'm not an attorney, but in my experience, the DMV usually charges a fee to have your license reinstated. Robbie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. Safe harbor policies in general, I think, are most effective when they've been kind of negotiated by whatever locality wants to use them. So I definitely encourage courts to look into that. One kind of blanket rule that I've heard before that I think is super helpful, and I think it was John Grayson that came up with it, the idea of the website rule, that if some piece of legal information can be found on the court's website or somewhere online, it's not really legal advice if you're just telling someone something that's showing up on a website. Mm-hmm. So if you say, you know, the code for the expungement statute is this, you could go look at that, or I can print it off and give it to you. They could find that online. You're not interpreting anything. You're not telling them anything. You're just providing something that they could find on their own if they went to Google or if they went to maybe a legal search directory. That's something we talk to our clerks about. Our self-help center attorneys maybe could go a little further than the website rule. But for those agencies that want to kind of keep it a little tighter, that's kind of what we talk to them about here in Franklin County. I'd be interested to hear what anyone else says about that, though.
Jenna?
So we do have safe harbor policies, and I think what's really important is it's starting with some clarification, providing clarification through the conversation, and ending with clarification as well. So to what you noted, starting with something like, in my experience, or here's how I've navigated or supported folks navigating this situation before, giving some of the legal information and details, and in the middle of that conversation, saying something along the lines of, you know, this is legal information that's available in this location. Here's where you can find it on your own, similar to what Robbie shared. And then going through the conversation, clarifying if they have any questions. And then again, ending that conversation with a reminder, I'm not an attorney, so I would encourage you to seek legal advice if you continue to have questions that I'm not able to answer for that reason today.
Danielle?
Yeah, I think this is a huge one, and training is the biggest piece for court staff. Understand what your policy is within your courthouse or within your state. what you're going to follow. And if nothing else, everything we do, you know, give people examples of what it sounds like and model it for them. So when you have new staff that comes in, model what that sounds like when a customer comes up to the counter and say, I don't expect you to know, call me and I'll come down and I'll talk to them so you can hear what it sounds like. So that way you understand what they're trying to get to. Because a lot of times as new staff as well, you don't know everything. Yeah. So you're also like, I don't know the answer to that question. So this is a really good training model of helping people understand the language that they can use. Oftentimes too, what we do is have a judge look at it. And we do a lot of plain language things. We tend to get tied down with what's the state statute, but sometimes like what's just the plain language of things. That's what people can truly understand. And like we talked about on websites, like if it plain language is it on the website, you're okay. And we have our judge actually go through and write our plain language for us. So we take a first attempt at it, and then the judge goes through and rewrites it in plain language for us. So we're really looking at things as, can everybody understand this? We don't have to go through and be so high level that we're talking above people.
Nathan?
So in San Bernardino, actually in California as a whole, our self-help programs are required to have a disclaimer on our intake stating that we aren't their attorneys. We can't give them legal advice. We're not representing them. So they're required to fill out. So it sort of does that. Gina was talking about the start of the conversation, having the start. And then I also advise my staff when I'm training them on this issue, using conditional language like you may do this, or this is an option that you have, or these are your options, so that they're making their choice, or they still have their control and agency. And we're not saying you have to do this, except in some like very straightforward procedural informations. And that's where I think Robbie pointed out like the website sort of rule. And that's also something I refer to, like our judicial counsel has a lot of great information on their website for self-represented litigants. And I'll use that as a training tool for my staff, saying like, yeah, if it's on there, that's probably something like you're comfortable talking about and explaining those different parts of the process as it goes through the different procedures and things like that. So that's sort of the tools that we use on that issue. But it is a very interesting, complex issue. Yeah.
I want to thank Jenna Elsness, Robert Southers, Nathan DeVries, and Danielle Trujillo for their perceptions and opinions on what courts should be telling self-represented litigants. This is a relevant topic that we need to continue to address if we're going to quell litigant frustrations. As always, my thanks to you court professionals tuning into today's episode. I know that you provide the maximum information possible to self-represented litigants, and you do it professionally. Thank you. Join us on Tuesday, June 18th, for another episode dealing with the issues facing our courts. This has been the Court Leaders Advantage podcast series. I'm Pete Kiefer, and thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining us today. The Court Leaders Advantage is a regular podcast series on courts and court administration. Today's episode will be available on our website, on the Court Leader website, on YouTube, Facebook, iTunes, LinkedIn, and on X, formerly known as Twitter. Become part of the conversation. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes, email us. Our address is podcasts@nacomnet.org. Did you hear an interesting comment by one of the panelists that you would like to listen to again, but you don't want to search the entire episode to find it? The additional resources section of the webpage has a question time marker sheet. Find the discussion question on the sheet, and next to it is the time that question was asked. You can quickly fast forward to that time and listen to the panelists' comments. Remember, if you don't have time to watch an episode, you can always listen to the audio version. Listen in your car or on the bus on your way to or from work. You never have to miss an episode. I'm Pete Kiefer, and on behalf of our guests, the Court Leader website, and the National Association for Court Management, thank you. And have a great day. The views, information, and opinions expressed during this episode are solely those of the host and the individual presenters. They do not necessarily represent the position of the National Association for Court Management.